welcome back to the Super Subcast. I'm your host, Ian Stewart, and with me today, I have my co-host, Nader Afuni. Nader, how's it going, man?
Hello. I'm good. How are you?
Doing fine. It's been, 2 weeks since we recorded the last episode. What have you been up to since then?
Yeah, already at a celebrity hiatus. No, not too much. I mean, been still consistently climbing, but I hurt my neck and head just trying to do something way too audacious. And that kind of put me out for a week.
So we never really got into what audacious means. What does that entail exactly?
It's just a little bit overly confident.
What did you try to do, like a giant leap?
Yeah, and it was like totally unnecessary too, the leap that I tried, because places where I could position my feet that would allow me to complete the route that I was doing without doing anything too insane. But I guess I just misread what I needed to do and took a big old leap of faith and just landed real awkward and woke up with a really stiff and sore neck for 3 days. And then the neck got better, but then the head started to hurt. And yeah, but nope, back to fine form and feeling good and ready to record these pods again.
Good. I'm glad to be back on our usual schedule. And I'm assuming that was probably like second or third time rock climbing. You decided to take a
big leap. No, I've been doing it. It was like one of those, it's too hot to do anything outside. Well, I started climbing during the freeze that happened in Texas. The roads were finally, you know, safe and weren't just smooth, like paths of death after some of the ice had melted in Texas. So we went to the climbing gym next door, and honestly, I just fell in love with it. So I've been doing it pretty, like, started in February, but only started doing it consistently around April, I would say.
Oh, yeah. I didn't know you've been doing it that long. That's awesome, man.
Yeah, thanks, man.
Anyway, so today we are going to have a deep dive topic and then talk about some current events. Nader, do you want to introduce what our topic is today?
Yeah, so we've got a really cool one today. We're going to be diving into the world of the Red Bull conglomerate and how Red Bull is sort of, I want to use the phrase dipped its fingers, but it's dipped its foot into the sour cream jar. They have a massive hold over many different teams across several sports. But we want to particularly focus on the football teams that they own and operate across Europe, South America, and the United States as well. And it just shows you American imperialist ideals. I named two continents, but then I said the United States. But anyway, yeah, so we'll be diving into those topics and just sort of thinking about, you know, what the implication is of a massive corporate presence in the footballing world. And then also just looking at the success of the teams and what the ultimate aim of the Red Bull company is.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. Just to give a little background on Red Bull, the guy who founded it is German. And this is the little history that I found about it. And that's going to be my input. The guy that founded it was German. He was living, I think, in Southeast Asia, I believe in the Philippines. And he found like a similar Red Bull type drink when he was there in the 70s or 80s and decided to take it back to Germany and recreate it, essentially. So we changed the name from, I think in Southeast Asia, it was translated in Asian as like Fighting Bull or Bull Red. So when he went back to Germany, just changed it to Red Bull. And his whole idea behind the energy drink was to like market it in like clubs and extreme sports. And without going too much into its history of what extreme sports it got into, it eventually decided that football was a good target to start in. So currently they have three or four teams that are under their umbrella. They have the New York Red Bulls. They have RB Leipzig, which is in Leipzig, Germany. They have Red Bull Salzburg, which is in Salzburg, Austria. And then I believe they have a Brazilian team as well.
Yeah, Red Bull Brazil, and then there's also one more, but I think they're semi-professional. Yeah.
Yeah, so their idea behind that is to try to expand the name of Red Bull in terms of marketing, and they found some success sponsoring football teams and actually owning the football teams. Mm-hmm. So do you want to dive into some of the specific clubs that I just mentioned?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you hit the nail on the head. Red Bull is just this incredible, powerful marketing conglomerate above everything else. And, you know, it found its footing in the world of football with Red Bull Salzburg. So in 2005, the parent company, Red Bull GmbH, and I don't know if that's meant to pronounce something, but GmbH doesn't sound too cool. So I'm just going to say GmbH.
That sounds right.
Yeah, GmbH. So they purchased their first football team in 2005, and the club Salzburg itself, which was originally SV Austria Salzburg, was only 24 kilometers from the city of Salzburg. So, you know, the village where Red Bull is headquartered. Interestingly enough, this team was sort of a middle of the table club. They had a decent sized local following. Without a super prolific history, I mean, in the 80s, they saw some relegation. They fought a few relegation battles, but and they saw some success in the mid-90s where they won first division titles. I think that was before it was the Austrian Bundesliga. And after purchasing SV Salzburg, they went ahead and named it FC Red Bull. So, you know, lots of creative juices flowing over at Red Bull. So, you know, from the very get-go, there was a heavy investment in infrastructure, talent acquisition, talent management, talent development. And this you'll see later through the episode becomes a theme of Red Bull, especially in its footballing acquisitions and even its Formula One, but we won't dive too deeply into the other sports. You know, the investment paid off very quickly. Within its first season, Salzburg had finished second place in the national championship. And they had also won the title the following season. And since then, I mean, it's all been history. They've become the footballing power of Austria. And since 2013, the club has gone on to win every Austrian football Bundesliga.
Since 2013?
Since 2013, yeah.
So they're on what, number 8 if they win this year?
Yeah, I mean, it's not 10 like Celtic, but...
Well,
9.
It's not 10 like Celtic. Way to bring up some horrible memories for me. Thank you.
Yeah. So they've essentially, you know, etched themselves in the Austrian Bundesliga as the top dogs, very hard to reach, very hard to beat. And I think we've explored this theme in previous episodes, but it creates serious concerns about how the power of a single economic entity, individual, industry, in this case, an energy drink corporation, can damage competitiveness essentially in a flip of a switch. Red Bull had seen amazing success with Salzburg and decided to continue to expand. And a year later, had entered the U.S. market and purchased New York Red Bull or New York Red Bulls.
Red Bulls.
Red Bulls. So at the time, prior
what
to
was their name before? Wasn't it like the Metro Stars or something?
It was.
Yeah, it's a horrible name. I think Red Bulls might be even better.
Yeah, not a big fan. I don't even think they were competing in the MLS at the time.
No, they were probably in the, was it the USL?
Mm-hmm.
Like the second division for America.
I'm not exactly sure which one they were in, but yeah, I think it might have been the USL. There are several leagues, but yeah, the USL and the MLS being the biggest ones, and the USL being the pipeline into the MLS. But yeah, I mean, essentially same pictures. There was plenty of investment in infrastructure, talent mm-hmm. management right from the very get-go. They took a certain different twist, and this is what we'll start to see as the key distinguishing factor as Red Bull as a sports interest owner. So they created the first cost-free program of junior football in Major League Soccer, in the MLS. So they were able to bring in young talent from all across the New York metro area, the Northeast, you know, all the surrounding areas where they could essentially demonstrate their skills to the Red Bull scouts and introduce a pretty foreign concept to U.S. sports, which is beginning at a very young age rather than building the true pipeline from college-aged athletes. And, mm-hmm. you know, if some of these younger players prove their worth and show that they were good enough to start working through the ranks, they would enter development systems and be able to promote them through different levels of the RB teams.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah,
I think that's a really good, because when you look at, you know, the sport in the US, like, it's very expensive for kids to play at like a very high level, like at the academy level. So doing that is definitely a good idea for opening up the game too, because you got to start them off young if you want to develop into the class players that can like compete for, like, if the U.S. ever wants to compete for World Cup, they need to make sure that every kid who has the ability or wants to can develop. And those academy systems at the MLS level are definitely a good start. Like, I know when I was growing up, it was starting to become like that, but now it's more and more prolific, where a lot of other MLS academies have been doing like grassroots. Like, I know they usually have like feeder clubs from local grassroots clubs, and then those like feed into the MLS academies if the players are good enough.
Yeah, and I'm glad it's starting to pick up, because in a sport like football, development just has to start at a very young age and has to be accelerated at a very young age, because you have thousands upon thousands of kids that are interested in the sport, want to pursue the sport, and to truly come out with the best talent once they reach the under 18 level, you sort of have to work through that pyramid and begin weeding out the skilled players, the players that mm-hmm. will develop the physicality, will develop the technical acumen as they start building up the ranks. So mm-hmm. yeah, I mean, Red Bull definitely introduced it as a novel idea in the United States. And like you said, it's starting to pick up.
Mm-hmm. Also with the New York Red Bulls, I don't know if they were like the first ones to kind of like bring over like the big name European players, but I remember Thierry Henry signed for them. I know like LA Galaxy usually tries to do that with as well. I think Sean Wright Phillips played for New York Red Bulls.
Yeah, they totally followed the MLS model of let's find some players that are way into the tail end of their careers and bring them in. But honestly, I think that's interesting, because, you know, football is definitely picking up popularity in the US. But in the past, I mean, we're talking 2006 was the acquisition of Red Bulls. I think the key differences between South America and Europe as compared to the United States was, rather than team recognition and a religious team following like we have now, it was more recognizable player names. So young people in America that were interested in football wouldn't necessarily be interested in Liverpool or be interested in Manchester United. They'd be more interested in David Beckham, Ronaldinho, mm-hmm. Ronaldo. It was more the stardom that was more attractive.
We love a star.
Yeah, absolutely. And
we love a story.
Yeah, you mentioned Thierry Henry. I think he's still the third highest scorer in their history, but I don't know if that's an outdated statistic, but I remember reading
we'll go with that one.
Yeah, yeah, that sounds good.
Anyway, so we talked about Salzburg, New York, and now the crown jewel of the Red Bull conglomerate.
Absolutely. So as a massive corporation, the ultimate motive is the bottom line. And you want to, as Red Bull, they want to be able to build a network of clubs that will ensure finding, nurturing, and selling just these absolute stars, almost in a factory line fashion. And by being able to reach the level of creating multi-continental stars, like you said, you need to find that crown jewel, a club in a highly competitive, highly recognizable league. And it didn't come easily, but the sort of last stop of reaching sort of their ultimate goal was RB Leipzig.
Yeah. So where do you look? The German fifth division.
Yes.
Isn't that where they started, the fifth division?
They had tried to take over clubs that were a little higher up. So they tried to go for FC St. Pauli, which is a smaller club based in Hamburg.
Oh, yeah. Love St. Pauli. I want to go see a St. Pauli Hamburg game.
I don't know if you're being sarcastic or not.
No, St. Pauli and Celtic fans got like that.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'd love to go see a St. Pauli game.
Yeah, well, there you go. And then they tried to buy TSV 1860 Munich, Fortuna Düsseldorf. But we'll dive into this in a little bit in the episode. But a lot of these acquisitions were met with director opposition, supporter opposition, protests. Mm-hmm. And Germany in general is against the idea of a corporation completely taking over a team. But
yes,
the Bundesliga was the perfect breeding ground for what Red Bull was trying to achieve. It had close geographic proximity. The languages are extremely similar. You have a high market top five European league. So in their eyes, securing a team in the Bundesliga was a must. So you had made the wise point, they did go to the fifth division. So they couldn't necessarily go for something more established. So they went to a small village, 13 kilometers outside of Leipzig, called, and I'm going to butcher this, SSV Markenstadt.
SSV Markenstadt.
Markenstadt.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, this team was playing in the Oberliga, which is the fifth level of German football.
The Oberliga? That's sick.
Oberliga.
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 Oh, man, we're just butchering all this.
Yeah, yeah. Thank God we don't have German viewers just yet. but, yeah, I mean, within a few weeks, the deal was closed and the owners of the club had accepted to sell their rights to Red Bull. Now, what's really funny is RB Leipzig followed, as you know, has the RB behind its name, just like RB Salzburg, RB New York, and then RB Brazil, etc. However, German rules do not allow a team to change the name for a corporate brand. So the RB does not stand for Red Bull in this case. It actually stands for Rasenballsport.
Oh, that sounds correct.
Do you know what Rasenballsport translates to, Ian?
In English? No, what's it translate to?
It translates to lawn ball sports.
Lawn ball sports, Red
lawn
Bull.
Ball sports.
Wow, I love that.
Yeah. So it could very well be cornhole or what's the one where you got to knock the ball through like the archways?
Knock the ball through the archways.
And you got
like croquet.
Croquet.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Croquet FC.
So yeah, this team's out here playing lawn ball sports. But yeah, I mean, it was a ridiculous but simple way to overcome the rule and maintain the RB acronym, which is, you know, the ultimate goal, like we've established. Red Bull, above being an energy drink company and a massive sports conglomerate, is an insane marketing engine, and they're damn good at what they do.
Oh, so, they're very good at what they do in terms of branding and marketing.
So they had a very ambitious plan that they outlined, and they wanted to bring RB Leipzig, the newly founded RB Leipzig, from the fifth division to the top level, the Bundesliga, in 8 years. And if they were able to do it at 8 years, as they had originally targeted, this would have been the fastest ascension in German football history. And lo and behold, they actually broke that record. Because in 2016...
Would they get in like 7 years?
They were able to do it. So they had acquired RB Leipzig in 2009. They were able to reach the Bundesliga and compete in their first Bundesliga game in 2016. So... yeah, you're totally right. They did it within 7 years and stayed within their 8 year target.
So, that's unreal.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's an unreal amount of success so quickly. Mm-hmm. I'd imagine with that success, the fans, they probably grew their fan base considerably, because I know there was a whole issue just trying to acquire the club before.
Yeah. And I mean, never mind ascending that quickly to the Bundesliga. In their first season, I think they had gone 13 games undefeated and were able to finish second place that season.
In the Bundesliga?
In the Bundesliga.
I don't think they still haven't won the Bundesliga though, right?
No, but this was their first season. Wait, do you mean have they won it yet?
I don't think they've won it yet. I think it's still been Bayern.
Bayern and, sure, and Borussia?
I think Bayern's won the Bundesliga like 8 years in a row now.
My gosh.
Yeah,
that's another topic.
But you know, Red Bull Leipzig, they're a pretty good club. They have some really good players, and I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, next couple of years they win it.
Yeah, and I suppose Leipzig's plans didn't just stop at reaching the Bundesliga. They wanted to be a competitor in one of the biggest European leagues, but next they wanted to enter the European stage and to begin profiting from this operation and to begin elevating the name of RB Leipzig and the Red Bull brand and the team in general. They began to source talents from some of their smaller clubs in Austria, the United States, and create a bottom-up feeder system to the main club in Germany. So a little like internal money ball, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think the best example of that is Jesse Marsch, who is the current manager of RB Leipzig. He started, I believe he started in Montreal, used to play, and then he had a short coaching stint at Red Bull, New York Red Bulls. And then I believe he was like an assistant at Leipzig, and then he got the head coaching position at Salzburg, did pretty well there. And then when Nagelsmann went to Bayern Munich this year, he got promoted to RB Leipzig, and that's where he's currently at. So they don't even just feed players, like they'll feed managers, which is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And what's cool about this is they didn't want to just stop in North America, in Europe. They even went further and tried to dip their hands into the Brazilian league and the Brazilian system and create a pipeline for South American players. So I think they had a short stint trying to establish a club called Red Bull Brazil, but they had faced a lot of licensing issues and you know, unsettled court disputes and whatnot. So they quickly pivoted away from that, but still wanted to remain in Brazil and had purchased the club Bragantino, which was a team in a mountain city in Sao Paulo. And, you know, within their first year in true Red Bull tradition, they won the Serie B, which is the second division in Brazil. And they invested very heavily in young players and were even able to poach players from Santos, Palmeiras. So they were getting some top, top talents very, very early on, just because they had the strong corporate backing. They're able to pay the wages and they have a proven experiment in Austria, in Germany, in the United States. And I just want to talk about some of the insane graduates of the RB system. I mean, close to me, Sadio Mane came from RB Salzburg. Naby Keita came from Salzburg as well. But then you have other incredible names that play in the Premier League right now, like Timo Werner.
Yep, he came from Leipzig.
Mm-hmm.
Haaland.
I was just going to say, Haaland.
Yeah, he came from Salzburg.
Yeah, that's probably like the biggest name. And then obviously Kimmich.
Kimmich came from RB Leipzig as well?
Yeah, he was a Leipzig player. He plays for Bayern Munich at the minute, doesn't he?
Yeah, he's really good. I just didn't... He was one of those players that kind of just popped out of nowhere. And he's amazing. But I didn't know that.
Yeah, and I mean, even Valentino Lazaro. I mean, he was acquired by Red Bull Salzburg when he was 15 years old. So, you know, they've created an incredible pipeline for themselves and have been able to profit from this network because, like we've just said, they've probably acquired these players for, on average, anywhere from £800,000 to £2 million, £4 million, £5 million, and have created insane market value out of them.
Oh, yeah. So what are your overall thoughts on a company owning football clubs and then kind of using it as one system? Because there are other examples out there. Like, I know Man City has like 6 or 7 like teams scattered throughout the world. Like, they have a team in Japan. They have a team in New York. And they obviously have Man City, but like, what are your thoughts on Red Bull doing it?
You're totally right. Man City has, like you said, operations across the globe. Fly Emirates has huge interests in clubs in Italy, the Premier League, so Arsenal, AC Milan, Paris Saint-Germain. So it exists. I think what's crazy about it is like, this is the most conspicuous, in-your-face example that we've seen of a corporation coming in and taking over clubs. I mean, they haven't been remotely discreet about it. It's very much like, we're going to come in, we're going to uproot your name, we're going to uproot a bit of your history, and we're going to start from the ground up. We're going to make you damn good, but this is what's going to happen. Because, you know, like I'll continue to bang on and say, Red Bull has always been in this to continue to promote and solidify its drinks position in the market and to continue to promote its name and seek other revenue generating avenues.
I think they have to do that because their only revenue generator is the drink. You got to diversify. So that makes sense from a business standpoint.
Yeah. So my thoughts on it overall, and we can talk about what German football fans think, but my thoughts on it overall, I don't think what they're doing is any different. They're sort of just following the wave of what the modern game looks like. Lots of money entering the sport, acquiring several clubs, moving players within clubs. I think what they've done is excellent. They've established strong networks of scouting, grassroots youth programs, really trying to bring in players that wouldn't have otherwise had a stage or a place to showcase their talent. and then send them off to some of the biggest clubs in Europe and go on to do massive things.
Yeah, they definitely have the football operations down to a T. But let's get into what the fans think, the German football fan.
Yeah, I mean, Germany is a special case, and it's you can see it in some of its bylaws. You can see it in just the general fan sentiment. You know, the reason why German football fans hate Leipzig so much goes beyond the anti-corporate sentiment that's so prominent among, you know, sports purists like ourselves and fans in Germany. You know, putting aside what happened between 38 and 45, Germany has a long tradition of being a left-wing country, left-wing politically, and, you know, its embracement of social democracy extends to the world of football. I mean, do you want to talk a little bit about what the 50+1 rule and what it stipulates?
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know, the 50+1 rule, it's a unique rule in the Bundesliga where essentially the fans have to have a majority stake in the club. So that's where the term 50+1. So think of it, you have 50% of ownership of the club plus one share. So you have a majority. And that's just to kind of stop like large takeovers coming in and, you know, kind of almost what Red Bull did, but they kind of got away with it by starting in the fifth division. And that's from what I can understand is what they did. I know a lot of, since the Super League came to fruition a few months ago, that it's been talked a lot about in England. Should they have a 50+1 rule? I don't think that'll ever happen in England just because of the amount of money it takes to perform well there and the fans just couldn't afford it. But I think it's really interesting. Also with the Bundesliga, like a club cannot be in debt, which I think it's very necessary to have if you want the league to be sustainable and healthy. I think the Bundesliga is a great league. They have really good fan attendance. I think a lot of other leagues could take some notes from them.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they've completely democratized the world of club ownership. And, you know, once you have a vested interest or you have like a financial interest in a club, never mind like the local ties and the passion for the players and the game, you know, it's kind of like being a shareholder of a company. There's that extra edge to expect the results and to want the results. And mm-hmm. I think, you know, the best thing is it prevents German clubs from being purchased by, you know, massive sheikdoms, Russian oligarchs, you know, shady human beings, like we said in our very first episode. You know, I think one of the things that really upsets German fans, especially building off of the 50+1 rule, is RB found a way to sort of subvert and avoid this regulation. So Borussia Dortmund has around 140,000 members in terms of paying members for the club ownership. Do you want to take a guess on how many Red Bull has as of, I think, 2 years ago?
I'm going to assume it's really low. Okay. I'm going to assume it's super low.
Think low and then go lower.
It's going to be like 100.
They have 17 members.
17?
Yeah.
So what, they just need 9?
Well, yeah, essentially Bayern Munich charges anywhere between, let's say, 30 to 60 euros for a membership. Mm-hmm. Leipzig intentionally outprices its supporters by slapping on a 100 euro joining fee and then an annual 800 euro charge for the right to vote on club matters.
So explain that to me. So there's only 17 eligible members to vote?
Yes.
So how does that work? Like, who are those 17 people? Are they just like planted? Do they work for Red Bull?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these 17 are almost exclusively Red Bull employees or corporate partners of the company. Mm-hmm. And they have control over whether or not they want to outprice new membership. So mm-hmm. it's just a massive, you know, fuck you to the values of German football, sort of the social democratic outlook of German society. And for anyone that just cares about maintaining the traditional values of the game. Mm-hmm. So I'm not surprised that it hasn't won any empathy or compassion from German fans in general.
No, there's always a loophole, and I'm sure Red Bull has plenty of lawyers on their legal team to find them. And obviously they have with this.
Yeah. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, if shit smells from a mile away with stuff like this. What's Bayern Munich Stadium's name?
Isn't it the Allianz?
The Allianz Arena. So they've also sold out their naming rights to massive brands. Mm-hmm. And you know, 12 of the teams in the Bundesliga have done the same. So there's always a way for corporate fingers to find their ways into the world of football.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Putting that aside, obviously what Red Bull's doing and what RB Leipzig's doing is just sort of like a flagrant FU to the world of German football. But, you know, by undermining the 50+1 rule, which is essentially just like the bedrock of maintaining a democratic, inclusive fan involvement in their club's board and direction and whatnot, is you don't want what Leipzig did to create precedent for other massive corporations to come and do the same and basically wipe away one of the biggest barriers to entry that have maintained this like democratic stature of German football. So mm-hmm. I think that's where a lot of German fan contempt comes from. But so far, the experiment has largely worked. So far, German football has still held true to a lot of those traditionalist values. But who knows what history will say. And by the way, the team is fantastic. They're such a joy to watch. Putting everything aside. Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking back to like their most recent tie against Paris Saint-Germain.
Hey, that was a good game. They should have won that game as well.
Definitely. I mean, for the first 25 minutes, it was a massacre. And I think they should have capitalized way more. Yeah, it by not capitalizing, Paris were able to like take a step back, take a deep breath and find their footing again, rethink how they want to approach the game. But yeah, they're just a very entertaining side to watch. And honestly, they're starting to become a scary team to have in your group. People don't look over them anymore. They're real competitors.
Yeah, their stadium looks pretty hard place to play as well. I think we'll know football is dead when it's RB Leipzig and RB Salzburg in the Champions League final one day.
Yeah. But you know, it's not one size fits all in the world of sports. I mean, football fans will tell you will continue to tell you about their opposition to massive corporations coming in and taking over these clubs, but then F1 fans will happily celebrate, because that's what F1 essentially is like, most racing sports, I suppose. Plenty of sponsorship, plenty of money injected, because they are very expensive sports.
It's totally different.
Yeah,
they're exactly. Like, yeah, give us all the corporate money.
Yeah, like I don't know how I feel about Red Bull in the world of football, but I love it in F1. Like, I love that Weber. We got to watch incredible racers like Weber, and now we get to watch young guys like Daniel Ricciardo. Who else races for them? I think Max Verstappen races for them too. So
you could have said any name and I would have been like, I don't know anything about F1.
Stewart. Yeah. They're just really good at keeping their fingers on the pulse of sports that excite people and events that excite people. They're involved in Formula One, they're involved in MotoGP, they're involved in ice hockey, and they sponsor like high speed air racing.
What about that guy? Is it Baumgartner who like jumped out of the stratosphere?
Exactly. They are geniuses at captivating just everyone on the planet.
Yeah, they made a huge return in terms of the marketing value with that event, which is pretty cool. Any final thoughts on the topic?
No, I wanted to close it out, and I wanted you to introduce our Twitter account. So I know we're starting to get some listeners. Just obviously, like to our friends and family and whoever else sharing that listens to this. Thank you so much. And if you did have any thoughts about this topic on Red Bull, feel free to tweet us at the account.
Yeah, so the account is at the Super Subcast at twitter.com. I've been trying to up that game a little bit back on the Twitter game. But yes, thank you to all of our listeners, friends, family, whoever you may be. We really appreciate it.
How about we pivot a bit? What do you got for us, Ian?
Yeah, so good topic, Nader. I'm glad to be back. So a lot of crazy things happened in those 2 weeks while you were recovering. Where to begin? So in the EPL, there's been a few managers that have gotten the sack. So we start with Norwich. Aston Villa, Dean Smith, he got the sack. Nuno at Tottenham. So what are your thoughts on those three starting?
Yeah, getting the sack has become such a empty term now. Managers are being just fired within 8 games. The cycle just continues to churn.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Nuno being a prime example, I think in August he was manager of the month, and now he's gotten the sack.
I think he got done dirty a little bit, to be honest. Obviously, he wasn't their first choice or second, third, or I've been hearing he's like the 7th or 8th choice, which kind of really surprises me.
It's so tough to walk into a changing room knowing that you're not necessarily the first choice and the players know that you're not the first choice. It just completely disrupts the dynamic and the respect and other elements of maintaining just a leveled changing room. But yeah, I mean, I remember prior to Nuno being hired, there was a lot of excitement about Mauricio Pochettino potentially coming back. And a lot of the news came out that he wasn't in Levy's plans. And the players know that too. The players talk to the owners, the players talk to the sporting directors, because, you know, when you have to be tactical when you bring in a manager, it's not one size fits all. You need someone that's going to match the play style of your players, or at least embrace the play style of the players that you have now. And if they come in and try to just uproot what's being built in the club and the momentum that's being built in the club, it's a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. And with that, Daniel Levy decided to, after Man United beat Tottenham at what's their stadium called? The Tottenham Hotspurs Stadium. They have a name for it yet, right?
Yeah.
I don't think they do.
No. Do they not?
I think they're still trying to sell the naming rights for it. Anyway, so they get destroyed by Man
United. It is the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. You're totally right.
What a great name.
Yeah.
So they get destroyed by Man United. Nuno gets sacked. A week later, Daniel Levy, he must bring out the checkbook or the Brinks truck or whatever, because Conte has signed for Tottenham. What are your thoughts on that?
Conte signing for Tottenham.
Well, he signed for Tottenham. He's played 2 games so far.
I don't think he put his boots on, but
he would. That dude's mad.
I think it's awesome. I think it's so great to have his personality back in the league. And he's perfect for Tottenham right now. You need someone that's going to square up some players and bang him into shape. And he's been at massive clubs. He knows how to deal with personalities, and he knows the pressure of the Premier League, especially with his time at Chelsea. So, and so far the results have looked decent.
They looked okay. He's only played 2 games, but his first game was literally, I don't even think he had a training session, and they still won the game.
Mm-hmm.
And then they tied Everton at Everton 0-0.
A great game.
So I guess they kept a clean sheet. Yeah, I think it's super exciting. It's exactly what Tottenham needs. They need to kick up the ass. Kane is in horrible form. Son, he's a good player. I'm excited to see what he gets out of them. Definitely a new formation. I think he usually goes with like the 3-4-3 Conte style. Yeah, I'm just looking forward to it. And to be honest, if Tottenham don't win a trophy with this guy, like, when do you call it? When do you lose all hope? Because if you can't win a trophy with this guy because I'd imagine they're going to spend, the rumor is they're going to spend $100 million this January transfer window, which doesn't really happen. Usually people don't spend in January, but obviously they convinced him by bringing his backroom staff and spending money. Like, if they don't win silverware with him, how do you feel? If you were a Tottenham fan, how do you feel about that?
Well, you have to.
Where do you go from there?
Yeah, you have to sit there and be pragmatic. It's got to be tough for Tottenham fans because they've gotten close. A couple of seasons ago, they'd finished second, and then they got to the Champions League finals in 2019. So I think what they need to do is go back to the drawing board and say, what silverware are we targeting? We're going to make maybe £100 million in acquisitions. So we'll have the breadth, we'll have the bench to be able to play lots of games, go through lots of rotations. But what's the ultimate goal here? Are we going for a domestic cup? Are we going to try to challenge in Europe? Are we going for the Premier League? I think there has to be just a clear communicated target that people can buy into. But I mean, a dry streak with trophies is so difficult, especially for a team of Tottenham's caliber. I don't think you lose all hope, I think you start to ask more questions of your players. You start to ask more questions of your manager, but this is something they need to capitalize on. Conte, a great team. This is the time.
Yeah, I agree. This is the time. They do have a chance with the League Cup. I believe they're in the quarterfinals right now. So that could be their first chance of getting silverware.
Yeah. Respectable.
I mean, if you haven't won a trophy in, like, I don't know, since 2008, which was the League Cup, you would take it all day.
Yeah, it's another trophy in your cabinet. It's another number on the tally. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I think a trophy is always a trophy, except for the Community Shield. The Community Shield is not a trophy.
Ah, useless.
In my opinion.
What about the Audi Cup?
What's the Audi Cup?
That preseason cup where like six teams compete in and it's all second under 23 teams.
Oh, man.
Yeah, never mind.
No, I don't think that that counts as a trophy either.
So Ian, I'm gonna hit you with one real quick. Sorry to interrupt you, but Dean Smith is out the job at Villa Park.
Yep, I was about to go to this as well.
Ooh, you know what name I'm about to bring up?
I know. He's been
Stevie Gerrard.
Stevie Gerrard.
Leaving Rangers for Liverpool for Aston Villa. What do you think of that?
I knew you were going to bring this up. You do a great, for everyone who doesn't know, Nard has a great Scousers accent. So what do I think of that? It seems kind of like every vacancy that comes into play.
He's always a name.
He's always a name that's floating around, which I it makes sense because, you know, Liverpool legend, great player career. He's had some success at Rangers. What do I make of it? So he came out, I think, like a week or two ago when Newcastle was looking for a manager, which we'll get to in a second. And he said, like, he pretty much said, like, do I look settled? Like, I don't want to go to the Prem. And he hasn't come out the last couple of days, said anything about Aston Villa. I know some of the Rangers fans are like pretty convinced that he isn't leaving. And personally, I don't think he should leave because I think he still has things to prove at Rangers. And if he goes to Villa, Aston Villa would be a really good managerial appointment for him, obviously. But I don't see him leaving mid-season. I don't see him pulling a Brendan Rodgers, the snake.
I was just going to say that.
Oh, man. Yeah, like going down to that level, like just going to the Prem.
I don't blame him if he does, though. This is a Premier League opening. I know there's going to be plenty. And I know vacancies always open up in the Prem. But I think Aston Villa is an excellent club to go to.
Oh, I would. Yeah, I think it's out of the between Newcastle, Aston Villa, and Norwich. I think Aston Villa is probably the most attractive.
Yeah, and if you sit there and you read Stevie's resume, what he really did at Rangers was he revitalized the club. He sort of put him back on their perch, if you will, and brought back you know, the old, I don't want to say the old firm, but essentially the Celtic Rangers co-dominance in Scotland. And I think that's what Aston Villa might need. Just someone that's going to be there to re-spark or ignite the fire in the club again and make the most of what he's got.
Yeah, I think it'd be an excellent opportunity. He has done well at Rangers. Like, we haven't won a game. I think the last game Celtic won I was at, it was like 2 years ago, which is unreal.
Yeah.
But I don't know if he's going to leave. And yeah.
But I think if he were to come to the Premier League, he can't just look at it as a stepping stone. He can't just look at it as another step up the ladder to Liverpool, you know? I think he has to find, because that he'd be making the same mistake that Lampard made, for example.
Yeah.
Where he did like a season or two at Derby and then went to Chelsea, and that was just too much to bite. So I think if Stevie could either stay at Rangers, continue to prove, maybe continue to challenge in Europe, which is an area they've shown some weakness in, and then make the transition to the Prem, build some experience there, understand what it's like on that side of the office in the Premier League, and then creep his way up to Liverpool, because, you know, I think the writing's on the wall. That's the ultimate goal.
Yeah, that's his ultimate goal. So another way to think about this as well, there's two things. If he doesn't win the league this year and then win one of the domestic cups, like he'll get fired, I would imagine. Because if you don't win, that's how those clubs work. You're done in Rangers or Celtic. Another thing is now I'm going to try to put my non-biased Celtic accountant hat on, but they need, I think, like 7.5-8 million quid by the end of the year to keep going in their operations, because they're their chairman has been actually bankrolling them with like low interest rate loans for the last couple of years. So I'm almost thinking if Gerard does go to Aston Villa, Rangers would get a payout. So I don't know if that comes into play at all. Like, because like when Brendan Rodgers and his backroom staff left, like Celtic got like 7 or 8 million quid for it. I'd imagine Rangers probably get the same amount.
You think that's, yeah, that might be something that's a motive. But I read a comment on a forum, and I think they made a good point. It's exciting, but it's not necessarily the best move right now, because, you know, switching mid-season is always difficult because you haven't really been able to lay the groundwork in the preseason. And he's not taking over a Leicester like Brendan Rodgers did. He's taking over a team that's in pretty poor form. And it just,
they have some good players, though. They have some good young players as well.
They do. But as a manager, you want to be able to reflect the end-to-end implementation of your managerial style and your plan. And that starts with a preseason. That starts with the first 10 games. That starts with managing the winter schedule, and then seeing the team through to the end of the season. If he comes into a team that doesn't have that, doesn't have any momentum or spark in them now, he's going to be wasting a lot of his early time at Villa developing that plan and implementing it.
Yeah. To be honest, I don't really care if he stays or goes, because I think we can take the lot this year.
But I mean, Rangers are fucked from a financial standpoint. They're definitely...
Oh, if they don't win the league, because in Scotland this year, since the coefficient's gone up, if they don't win, whoever wins the Scottish league gets an automatic Champions League bid, which is 40 million. And they need that money. We also need that money, but they need it more. So if they don't win the league, like, they're going to have to sell quite a few of their more valuable assets.
Yep. Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on. Yeah, good discussion. Always talking about Steven Gerrard.
Stevie Gerrard.
Can't do it. Yours is so good. Eddie Howe is the new manager at Newcastle United. It was announced, I believe, yesterday or today.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
Honestly, I like it.
In your dad's thoughts.
My dad's thoughts. I was WhatsApping him back and forth, and he liked it. He liked the appointment a lot. And at first I was a little bit but I now know why I was because I think there a lot of the excitement around the Saudi acquisition of Newcastle was like, we're going to get the best of the best from day one. But let's reel it back to reality. There's still a team struggling in the relegation battle. Mm-hmm. And I don't think any top manager that was in contention for a job, or quote unquote in contention, would get close to Newcastle with a 10-foot pole, because these big managers, that's not their job. They're not in, like, Conte is not interested in working relegation management. He's interested in winning big European trophies, and he doesn't want a relegation on his resume. So honestly, I think Howe was the perfect guy that you could pick for that. He's brought a team up. He's kept a team in the Premier League. Unfortunately, they did get relegated, but he's really proven his worth as a young, exciting manager. And I don't want to call it a stepping stone, but this is an excellent start for a revitalization project at Newcastle.
Yeah, I think that's what their whole plan is, to maybe have a stepping stone manager to, you know, steady the ship for 2 to 3 years. And then once they're more developed and they start bringing more talent, kind of like how Man City did gradually, they'll bring in that top manager then to go, you know, compete for the top four and winning the league. In terms of Eddie Howe, yeah, like, I think, I don't know, I see him get slated a lot online. I don't really understand why. I mean, he did take Bournemouth from League Two to the Prem, which I don't know how many other managers have done that, but that's an amazing achievement in itself. And then obviously he did get relegated after spending like 100 million quid on a transfer window. But I think he's a good manager, and I think, will they get relegated, though? That's the thing. If they get relegated, he's gone, obviously. But they're currently, I think, in second to last with 8 points, tied with Norwich, I believe.
Yeah, I'm actually in full transparency searching it up right now. I'm looking up the table. They're sitting in 19th right now. They're 3 points behind Burnley and tied on points with Norwich. So they're deep in the relegation battle.
They're in a relegation scrap. And I know Eddie Howe has worked with a couple of the Newcastle players before his time at Bournemouth.
Yeah.
But where do you see that going? Do you think he'll be able to dig them out? Because I would imagine by January, they don't want to be in the relegation zone anymore because they probably have, what, like 7 or 8 more games before the new transfer window comes up. And I'd imagine they'd probably invest some players just so they don't get relegated this year, because that would really foil a lot of long-term plans.
They've got great players. It just really depends on what kind of a system Eddie Howe wants to implement. Is he going to replicate what he did at Bournemouth, where it was, you know, very direct football, very high-paced, high-intensity, you know, really resting on the set pieces with Ake and mm-hmm. The other center. But anyway, but it'll be an interesting start. Mm-hmm. He's got the team that we've cursed, Brentford.
I was literally about to bring that up. I apologize, Brentford. We jinxed you.
Yeah,
we jumped the gun too quickly on you in episode 2.
We got so excited.
We did. They're still. They're still good.
They've lost like what, 2 in a row now.
Yeah, ever since we were bigging them up, they just have not done well. But yeah, their first game, Newcastle's first game, is against Brentford.
So that's
will be interesting.
Yeah, that's a team on a downward spiral. So, mm-hmm. Well, temporary, I hope. But there's some points you can pick up. Arsenal away. I don't want to get too confident about it. But then you've got Norwich and Burnley.
There it is, right there. That's relegation. That can get you out of there right there.
You pick up 6 points against them and you're out. And you've suddenly got a path to staying in the Premier League.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting how by the time the January transfer window, because like imagine if they're like in 20th come January, which they could based on these who they're playing in the next month, what they'll like, would they just throw a bunch of money at players that Eddie wants? Because they can't get relegated. They just cannot afford that. Yeah. I don't care how much money they have. It would just ruin a lot of momentum.
Definitely. I mean, you're going to invest an entire year of resources and players leaving and then having to rebuild the squad just to come back in. I mean, mm-hmm. to MBS, it's a marketing disappointment. It's not a financial disappointment. For Newcastle fans, it's a massive step back. It's definitely a punch in the plan, but you don't want to have to rebuild from the second division, from the Championship. You want to rebuild from a fresh start in the Premier League. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't think relegation is an option, honestly. I think that's the discussion that they had with Eddie.
Don't get relegated.
Don't get relegated. Whatever you do, you need to keep this team in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then one other topic I want to talk about is Man United. Hot topic right now. Have been in really poor form. It seems like your club just killed them.
All is at the wheel. At the wheel. All is at the wheel. La 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 la.
That's what you guys were singing, right?
All is at the wheel.
At Old Trafford. Oh man.
Yeah. I think I sang it for like another hour after the game had ended. Yeah, what is going on at Man United?
That's another team that needs to kick up the ass. Actually, right before we started this episode, I saw a clip where Tyson Fury was suggesting, like, you know, the boxer, he was like talking about like going to the grounds with Patrice Evra and like slapping some heads around.
Yeah. Yeah. Celebrities have had some very interesting takes. I think Conor McGregor had tweeted out that you've got an issue of level. How did he phrase it? It's just like the respect or the power dynamic is missing, because when Ronaldo was initially playing at Man United, Solskjaer was sitting at the bench. And what he was basically saying is you need a guy at the helm. You need a guy that can manage that star power, that knows how to put Pogba in line, that knows how to put Ronaldo in line. But I mean, honestly, if we want to like isolate the Liverpool game alone, shambles, just like Maguire made so many elementary mistakes.
He just can't do the basics.
Yeah. You had Cristiano Ronaldo, who was frustrated the entire game, which is not a good sign. You don't want a player as big as him sending those kind of negative vibes throughout the field, and other players begin to pick up on it. and you have an undisciplined side. First of all, what are you doing starting Fred over Pogba? And then Pogba does come on, and within 15 minutes, he's sent off. That's not just a mistake. That's recklessness out of frustration and lack of discipline in a side.
I think there's something else with the something else going on with Pogba, because apparently today he said he got an injury at his French training for the France national team,
which is code for I don't want to play.
Yeah, I don't want to play anymore. I know he has I think it's his last year in his contract, so I'm pretty sure he's just done at Man United. And in that Liverpool game, they were so disconnected. They were essentially playing like four forwards with who was it? I think it was Ronaldo, Bruno,
Greenwood,
and Rashford. Yeah. And then McTominay and Fred were in the middle. They were just getting passed by, and then the back four of Man United could not handle your guys' amazing front three.
It was a training ground day for Liverpool, honestly.
Yeah, another training ground day. I don't know if you watched the Man City Man United game.
Oh my goodness.
This weekend. That was a training ground.
Yeah.
Type game, because I'm pretty sure Man City had like 75% of the possession, and they just look like they have no fight. Man United, I'm super surprised they haven't sacked the guy, especially with all these other teams, you know, sacking and trying to appoint new managers.
Yeah, well, since it's like we're coming towards this last topic, like, what do you think it is? Do you think they're waiting for him to put his arms up in the air and say, you know, I've done what I can at this club, and it's the experiment isn't working and I need to go? Or like, you just think the ownership doesn't have the minerals to sack a name like Ole Gunnar Solskjaer? I don't think he's going to put his arms up. I don't think option A is in the cards, because he came out after the Liverpool game and said, we've come too far to quit. We've come too far to back down, which is him basically saying like, yeah, I have something that's proven and that's working, and this is nothing but a setback, which is outrageous.
Yeah, I always see fans make the suggestion like, you're doing so bad, like, if you really cared, you would just leave the club. Obviously, as a manager, you're not going to leave the club if you're making 10 to 12 million pounds a year. You're not just going to walk away from that money, even though it's more about the club over money. I don't see why someone would do that. Also, with the owners of Man United, I just don't think they really care. I think they're more of a corporate stooges, and they just want to get top four. And as long as Ollie can get top four, then that's all right with them. They don't really, because coming into this season, people thought Man United were going to be competing for the title, and on paper they should be, but I just don't think the ownership really, really cares.
Yeah. Well, one last thing. How cool is it? I know we just came out of a loss against them, but pretty cool to see West Ham sitting in the top four. Above Liverpool.
Yeah, transition to ex-Man United manager David Moyes. He's been doing super well at West Ham, and I'm loving it.
Yeah, you know what? He did incredibly well at Everton, which I hate to admit and say as a Liverpool fan, but, you know, he kept them in the Premier League. He kept them as a top six club, top eight a lot of the time, but still a very relevant club. And then he's doing really, really well at West Ham. Why do you think United was the anomaly? You know, he was the chosen one by Sir Alex Ferguson, and he was sacked within a season. Like, Moisey's a good manager. What went wrong?
Yeah, looking back to that season, so I think when he got sacked, he was in fifth, right? So they just went from having the greatest manager ever in Sir Alex Ferguson and winning like Premier League titles like every other year, every 3 years, to being outside the top four. They just didn't give him enough time. And obviously, since that sacking of him, they've just been bouncing around managers. They had Van Gaal, they had Mourinho, and now they have Ollie.
Yeah.
And ever since that, like, maybe they should have kept David Moyes another year and not jumped the gun, because they did him dirty that season. They should have kept him.
Absolutely.
He didn't have enough time to like implement a system, bring his own players in, and they got rid of him before the season was even over.
Yeah. I think when you're like a 25 year football empire, just dominating your league, dominating in Europe as well, to an extent, you hit panic button quite a lot pretty quickly. And I think that's what happened with Moyes. Initially. Yeah.
Now I think it's, sorry to interrupt you, I think it's come full circle where now they're overcompensating for their mistake years ago, and they're not sacking Ollie.
You're totally right.
Because I don't think he's going to, I just don't think he's going to bring success like they want. They should move on, obviously.
Yeah, well, looking at their next few games, they've got Watford, which is not an easy game. They've got Villarreal in the midweek for the Champions League away. And then they've got Chelsea and Arsenal. I mean, it is just
wow.
Between now and December, it is tough.
There's one thing I'll give Ollie credit for, though. When his back is against the wall, he comes up the results. So maybe he can win these next three games in the Premier League.
Honestly, if he could take 7 points out of Watford, Chelsea, and United and Arsenal, he could have just bought himself another lifeline.
Yeah, honestly, I don't think since they haven't sacked him yet, they probably won't sack him until the end of the season for some reason.
I don't know. I think if he loses all three of these, I'm not including the Villarreal game, people are going to start asking more than ask questions.
Mm-hmm. And I know we're wrapping up this episode, but the rumor for the new Man United manager is actually Brendan Rodgers. Is he going to double down and leave Leicester midseason?
I don't buy the rumor mill, honestly, because it's always the
so
same
happy
names.
If that being, happened.
Yeah.
I would be so happy that happened, because during that time, like, the Leicester fans online were just giving it to us. So yeah. I would just love if he did it to them.
But Brendan would be an idiot to leave what's working at Leicester for a shambolic Manchester United. And then never mind the fact that he worked at Liverpool too. So that wouldn't bode well at all.
It is Man United though.
It is a big job, but never mind how big the job is and the pedestal we want to put it on. He has a good thing going on at Leicester, so why leave?
All right. I can see that.
Yeah.
Yeah, do you have any closing thoughts on the episode?
I think this was great. I mean, I think the Red Bull topic was a very cool one, and definitely just in theme of the first couple of episodes that we've had, and it's definitely a theme that we should continue to poke at and question, because, you know, the presence of money in the sport and its growing influence in the sport shouldn't be something that's gone unnoticed. We should continue to scrutinize it, ask questions about it. So I'm glad we're discussing these topics. And honestly, like, this has probably been one of the most exciting Premier League seasons that I've watched.
Yeah, it's been wall to wall, top four this year. It's been very competitive. It's been really entertaining. I'm really excited to see where the rest of the season goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if we just flash up the table really quickly before we close out. The difference between sixth, or actually eighth and first, is only 10 points. Not the widest margin.
No, not at all. And how are you feeling? You guys are sitting in fourth right now.
It's a little scary. Not scary per se, but I think I like to look at it holistically. I like to look at the season as a package. Mm-hmm. And I think dropping points against Brighton was completely our doing. We took the foot off the gas, and they responded very, very well. And they're a dangerous side. Graham Potter has done a really good job at Brighton. Losing to West Ham, I think that was also just a very disjointed, outplayed Liverpool. They just looked so much better than us on and off the ball. But I'm not going to give up anything just yet. We have Arsenal coming up, which will be a good game. Mm-hmm. Southampton, and then onto the Merseyside derby. So still a lot to look forward to.
Where's that one at? Is that Anfield?
It's at Goodison.
Oh, can't wait till Rafa comes home.
he'll have a good reception, no doubt.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
Ooh, all right, we'll see.
I think Liverpool fans were split on it at the beginning, but they were like, the angle that they sort of took to accept it was, he's not taking a job with a rival. He's taking a job with a Liverpool team. You know, this man's family still lives in Liverpool. He did so much for the Justice for the 96 campaign. He's a Liverpool man through and through. And that's sort of the angle that they're looking at it from.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Anyway, Nader, I think this has been a good episode, and I just want to say thank you to all of our listeners, and follow us on social media. And I've been Ian Stewart.
I am still Nader Afuni.
And this is the Super Subcast, episode 4. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.